would you like to become a resilient leader with Endurance Leadership? Tony Lloyd will tell us how. And what's so special about Tony is he's an endurance athlete and he has run marathons around the world. And this year he lost 25% of his lung capacity to cancer surgery. And he's trying to work out how he's going to get 100% of 75% of his lungs. And he's the founder of Culture Shift Advisors and the creator of Endurance Leadership Framework. And he's also a former Fortune 500. He's also a former Fortune 500 executive, a TEDx speaker, a best-selling author, and the host of Social Entrepreneur, a podcast ranked in the top 1% globally. So, Tony, tell us about how can entrepreneurs leverage the mindset of an endurance athlete to become a resilient leader? Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu. Mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services. Leader.
Right, right. Well, you know, I'm going around giving keynote talks, and they say that really keynote speakers talk about the thing they need to learn the most, right? You know, so if you don't mind, I'll give you just a little bit more sort of framing of this, and then we'll talk about what that means to entrepreneurs and business owners and business leaders, right? So on April 29th of this year, I was moving into a new apartment. And the reason I was moving into a new apartment was because I was going through a divorce. And that's not fun, right? I mean, lots of us have been through this kind of experience, but it's, it was a really hard moment in my life. And so here I am, like with my things in boxes and I'm putting them into my apartment. And I get a text that says, you know, hey, there's something in my chart. So my chart is the little portal that my doctor uses. So I go to my chart and the first word I see on there is malignant. And I'm like, okay, great. Oh my goodness, one thing after another. So it turns out I had a malignant tumor in my left lung. I've never been a smoker. And so here I am, I'm going through a divorce. You know, there are other things that are big changes, major changes in my life, moving, you know, if you took all the top 10 stressors and you put them together at the same time, I was checking all 10 boxes. So I am a marathoner, as you mentioned. I had some plans for the Sydney Marathon, which I ended up running. I also, just a few days ago, the New York City Marathon was going on. I had been invited to that as part of the Age Group World Championships. But in the middle of all this, they've made this decision that maybe we can't wait on surgery, and so I have to have surgery. So, you know, I'm going through this stuff in my life. They removed 25% of my lungs just a few weeks ago. I'm now trying to get 100% out of the 75% that's remaining to me, as you mentioned. But I had, you know, like I'm still talking to entrepreneurs and business owners and all this about what they're going through, because I do some coaching, I do some workshops, I do some keynote speeches. And I was talking to this one woman who was leading an organization, and she was telling me about what she's going through. And I said, man, it sounds like you're between a rock and a hard place. And she said, rock and a hard place, nothing. I'm in the rock tumbler, right? Like if you've ever seen one of those little rock tumblers that polishes rocks, right? There's other rocks in there that are beating against it, and there's grit and there's sand and all this. And that's what it felt like for her, right? And so then I started thinking about this idea about being in the rock tumbler, about really getting hit from every side, right? So if you're a business owner, you're going through in your business, basically what I was going through in April, you know, you've got supply chain issues, you've got tariffs. Are the tariffs on or are the tariffs off? You know, if you make microchips, if you're using microchips out of China, What happens if they get angry and they stop sending them to you? You know, you've got talent management issues because you've got, you know, do we have the right people in the pipeline coming up? So it's like we're getting hit from every direction all the time. And that's happening to, you know, I'm in the United States. So the people in the United States, we're in the middle of big kind of political upheaval right now. And whether you're progressive or you're conservative or whatever, it just feels like you're getting hit from every direction. And then, you know, everything is disrupted for us as humans. Now you take a human and you put them in this complex organization called a business. And now you put that person in a leadership role. And now you put that person in a business owner role or a leadership, you know, an executive role. We're all in the rock tumbler, right? So I think for me, this is the concept that has grabbed me. And I want to come back in a second and talk maybe a little bit about the difference between resilience and endurance. But we're in it. Right? We're all in it. We're going through it together. So I think we all need endurance. And so I'm taking what I know from being a Fortune 500 executive and an endurance athlete and a person who is living through cancer surgery. And I'm putting all that together in this concept called endurance leadership. And I have a research partner who's helping me to do peer-reviewed research. And I've got, you know, writers and I've got all this stuff. And we're working on this thing. And so I'm really getting in my body and in my bones what it really means to be an endurance leader. So taking the lessons of endurance athletes and applying it to leadership. So that's the framing, that's the setup. So let me just pause for a second, Lily, and let you jump in there then.
Thank you. So I find, for example, for me, I am very resilient when it comes to certain activities and not so resilient when it comes to others. So for example, when for a long time I was doing property management, okay? And for the last 14 years, I've been doing that. And at some point, I was managing 30 properties, and I had a lot of, you can say, rooms, because I was renting basically the properties by the room. And, you know, people were, you could say, leaving every month. You know, let's say 10 people were leaving every month, and every month there was a new, you know, a new influx of rooms to rent. And there was always a lot of maintenance to do. Okay. So like painting or cleaning or this kind of thing. And in the beginning, in the very, very beginning, I would actually go and I would paint the rooms myself because I assumed there would be no budget for that, you know, and I didn't know how to do it. But what I found is, for example, I'm still, even now, 14 years later, you could still have me, let's say, start at 8 a.m., and then I could work the entire day painting all day long without drinking and eating anything. And I would have the resilience to do that. No questions asked. But I wouldn't have the resilience to send 24 hours of sales proposals, for example. So I'm wondering, why do I have resilience, like physical endurance and physical resilience? But not so much emotional and not so much like emotional toughness and emotional strength as to like send thousands of sales proposals, for example, and how do I get that?
Well, that's a good question. And so I do want to just sort of touch on this idea. So you're using the word resilience, and if you look at my website, like I mentioned resilience, it's important, resilience. But here's a difference. Resilience means to bounce back after a setback. Right. So as a runner, you know, I go and I have a race and it's a hot day and it's a terrible day and I have a bad race and I'm sort of beating myself up and I'm feeling exhausted and all that. Well, you know, I get some rest, I sleep a little, I drink a little, I eat a little, I commiserate with my friends, and then I bounce back. Here's what's happening today is for people is there's no time, and I'm doing my hand. I know people on the podcast can't see it, but I'm kind of doing my hand like this, sort of held down, because it's like it's all coming at us at the same time, right? So really, resilience is important, the ability to bounce back from a setback. But what we really want is endurance, where we can endure, we can stay in something for a long time, right? So that's part of it. The second thing I'll say is we all have our zone of genius. You know, my dad had just a tremendous work ethic. And so I get what you're talking about, Lily. I have that same kind of work ethic. I, you know, recently, because I'm writing right now and I'm working on workshops and I'm helping people, I'm waking up, my heart on fire, my brain on fire. I'm waking up at 3-4 o'clock in the morning and I'm working. And then like at 8 o'clock at night, I'm like, okay, I got to put this away and all that. Right. And that's okay for a sprint. It's not okay for a marathon. It's okay for me to just do this for a period of time. I'm in startup mode on something. And so that's fine. But I think we all have our zone of genius, right? So maybe writing sales letters and sending them off and bidding on phone calls and trying to get somebody who's on the, you know, and there's, you know, I mean, it's a miserable experience to do cold calls. It's a miserable experience to try to, you know, get people to just open up their frame and see you a little bit, to grab some of their attention, right? So I get that we have a genius in one area, but not necessarily in another. So maybe that isn't your zone of genius. Maybe what you need is you need a partner who their zone of genius is sales and marketing and all that kind of stuff. And so maybe you need to lean in to the things that you're great at, because those things energize you. Now, the other thing I will say about this is, we can, you know, when I began running marathons, I didn't just wake up on a Tuesday and go, I'm going to go run a marathon, right? There is this sort of conditioning of the body to get ready for a marathon. So you want to build a base of aerobic fitness. And then on top of that big, large base of aerobic fitness, you add in some, you know, some speed work and you get faster at it. And that there's a whole training regimen that goes behind getting ready for a marathon start line. In fact, I would say I rarely show up at a marathon start line if I haven't already run about 750 miles in training. The same can be true with our sales or our other, you know, areas where it's not our zone of genius, but we can introduce small things that we can do and then introduce something else and then introduce something else. So when it comes to building endurance within an area, excuse me, part of that is just building up a tolerance for an activity that isn't necessarily in our zone of genius. So that's the quick answer from me.
Thank you. How does someone who, let's say, for a long time, my zone of genius was sales as well, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. something happened where I kind of lost that. And it feels almost like it's not that sales don't come to me, but it's like when it comes to actually sending the sales proposal, I just don't feel like doing it. So tell me, how does someone who perhaps doesn't feel like doing the kind of activities that they know would lead towards productivity, how do they get themselves to do it anyway?
Yes. Lily, I love that question. It's such a good question. You know, when I wake up, I live in Minnesota. And so when I wake up on a February morning and I have a 10-mile run on my schedule and it's snowy and it's icy and it's 20 below, well, there's a couple of choices here. One is I can go indoors and facilitate that in a way that I don't have to go out, but then I'm on a treadmill, or a lot of us call that the dreadmill, right? 10 miles on a treadmill, just going and going, right? But it's an accommodation. The other thing that I can do is feel the dread and do it anyway, right? Because sometimes making micro progress will help you to do the entire thing. So when I'm getting ready to go for a run, the first thing I do is I put on my running clothes. And just that ritual of putting on my running clothes and getting my shoes on, and I'm lacing up my shoes, and now I'm going to go for the run. And then that's the only victory I need so far. And then a friend of mine said, if you get dressed and you're ready to go for a run, but you just don't feel like it, he said, walk out to your mailbox. Just walk to the mailbox. And so if you've got a mailbox in front of your house, you just walk out there and you just stand there for a second. And then you go, you know what? I'm already here. I just might as well go for a little run while I'm out here, right? So part of it is like, feel the fear and do it anyway. It's that kind of thing. It's feel the discomfort and do it anyway, because it's the demand, right? It is the demand of the job. Now, is there a way for you to automate some of this stuff? Is there a way for you to, you know, to remove resistance? You know, and even I lay my running clothes out the night before I go for a run, because removing resistance is a great way to make progress towards your goals. If I wake up and now I've got to go figure, oh, am I going to run? What's the temperature? I don't understand, right? There's a lot of resistance there. So if I look at the temperature the night before, I know what temperature and wind conditions are going to be the next day, then I can go lay out my running clothes and get ready to go and go. And I did the same thing, you know, when I was in my corporate career. The night before, I would make sure my suit or whatever I was wearing at the time, you know, it was all pressed, it was all ready, it was all hanging up, it was ready to go. I knew what I was going to do in the morning. I had the coffee ready to brew, you know, so just removing resistance, removing the things that rub as we're trying to get things done, right? That's a good way to get yourself to do the thing you don't want to do. So those are just some ideas.
Thank you. Yeah. So many years ago, when I wanted to kind of like get fit and be happier, what I started doing was like a happiness calendar. And what I was doing was that I had set out different things, like going to the gym 3 times and going dancing 3 times a week and walking 20 kilometers on a Saturday and all these different things.
Yeah.
And I found that I had put myself like a precondition that in case I don't feel like doing that, I'm going to do it anyway. And I found it, you can say, relatively easy to follow on with that program of going to the gym, even if I was too tired, even if I was working until 10, I would still go from 10 to 11. Yeah.
Right.
But what I find, for example, when it comes to like, I'm bringing again the sales proposals, okay? For a long time, I was doing property management, and I was, let's say, renting rooms from, let's say, 550 to 1,000 something pounds per month. And the value was relatively low. It's non-scary at all, right? Whereas now it's like my programs are more like 25 to 100K, and it just feels a lot scarier to do that. So I'm wondering, for someone who is experiencing fear and doing certain tasks that they have to do, that they know will lead to the biggest outcome, how can they get themselves to do it and remove that resistance that you talked about, where the distance between, you can say, the comfort level and the task that they have to do is like so big that they don't really know how to like bridge that gap?
Right. Oh, Lily, let's talk for a second. Let's talk about this. So first of all, I love that you said that you had this sort of happiness calendar. My writing partner and research partner is a woman named Jen Wiseman, and she has a saying, keep track of the good, right? So we're in the middle of, like, you know, there's like upheaval everywhere, right? There's just like, there's this churn, and we're all in the middle of the churn. And sometimes it can be really burdensome. We're like, oh my God, the world is awful, right? But the truth is that there are really wonderful, amazing things that are happening in the world. And so part of it is just keeping track of the good. But let me ask you some questions, right? So it's just hitting send, right? It's, you write the email, you frame it, and then you hit send. When you were selling things for, you know, 100 pounds or 1,000 pounds or whatever, you didn't seem to have any issue with just hitting the send. So what's standing in your way? Why is this scarier? Why is this email scarier than other emails?
I think that with the previous one, let's say I had thousands of clients, you know, like I had, let's say, 120 potential clients every day that were bidding for, let's say, 10 rooms. So the likelihood of me renting that was like so high that I didn't even have to bother. It was just a matter of me choosing who I was going to give it to. Whereas now it's not, I can't say that, oh, I have, I don't know, 10,000 super high ticket clients. And then, you know, like messing up is so much bigger in terms of impact. And also, I think that I fear as well them feeling like I'm, I don't know, taking them for a ride of some sort, just because like the price tag is like so high. And like, for example, like I'm promoting this event sponsorship ticket. And, you know, some people want to be paid to speak. Some people are happy to invest in sponsoring something, knowing that they can speak at that event, and then they can get, like, right, you know, a super high ticket client for selling their right $100 million building, for example, right? Right. So it's an opportunity right for them. Right. But I right still fear, yeah, you know, that perception they might have, or they might think, oh, actually, Lily only has super high ticket items, therefore I won't talk to her again, kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So I hear a couple of things in there. I feel like we're in a therapy session, and I am not a therapist, right? So, you know, just keep in mind, this is old Coach Tony, right? You know, you got this old Fortune 500 guy who's sitting here having a conversation with Lily. So, you know, here I am. I heard a couple of things. So one, I heard, I used to have more clients, and now this is a select group that I'm selling to, and the consequences feel dire. Like if I don't get this client to bite, then there are not that many more clients out there for me to get to. Well, in my, so I mentioned that I went through a divorce, and it's not something I like to dwell on or anything, but there was a saying that came out of that. My former spouse, wonderful, wonderful woman. I have nothing but great things to say about her. But when we were splitting up the assets, you know, she kept asking for a little bit more. Oh, I have this reason. I'd like to have a little bit more cash. I'd like to have a little more of the, you know, et cetera. And it's reasonable, right? I mean, we have these reasonable conversations in which I went, yeah, that makes sense to me. And here you go. And I gave up a lot, right? Financially, I gave up a lot during that divorce. And you know, divorce is such an ugly, nasty topic. I hate to even bring it up, but it was a good illustration of the fact that when she and I were talking, we were talking about slicing up the pie. And in that pie, if she got more, I got less. I mean, that's just the physics of it all. You know, if there's, you know, some 10 slices of pie and she gets 7 and I get 3, you know, well, that's it. But here's what I know in my heart. There's a lot more pie. Like there's pie everywhere. And I love pie. Give me a cup of coffee and a slice of pie. I will be happy all day, right? And so in this situation, and she wasn't being scarcity minded, she wasn't being afraid, right? She was being reasonable, and she was, you know, we were having honest, reasonable conversations about how do we split our assets. But I was able to be extremely generous with her. I was able to say, to be really not self-sacrificing, but to say, yeah, I understand. That makes a lot of sense. You get more pie than I do. Great. You take more pie. Sorry, I'm getting a call on my phone, and I hope that doesn't interrupt. So I was able to be generous with her, because I know there's a lot more pie, and keeping in mind that this client is not your own, like the kind of person you serve, there are a lot of them out there. You may not have them on your list right now. They may not be in your flow desk or your whatever system you're using, your CRM. They may not be there yet, but there's a lot of them. And it is shocking the number of high wealth individuals there are. I mean, we could have a conversation about why there are so many high wealth individuals another time, right? But the truth is there are a lot of people out there with wealth and the ability to do something like this. Here's the other thing. When you talk to someone and you say, this is who I am, and this is what I do. And my friend Kevin, I have to attribute this to my friend Kevin Jennings right now. He taught me this, and this is a great lesson. When you tell someone, this is who I am and this is what I do, then they put that in their memory bank. And maybe they're your customer or maybe they're not. But they put that in their memory bank. And then later, when they run into somebody who says, boy, I've got this need, this thing is happening, I really, you know, I'd like to be able to have these high ticket items and these, you know, big real estate deals and everything, then your friend's going to go, you know what? I know Lily And this is who she is and this is what she does. So when you say to somebody, this is who I am and this is what I do, they tell other people, this is who I am and this is what I do. And then when they do that, the opportunities that come to you, they are changed because you have told somebody and they told other people, this is who you are and this is what you do. And so keep telling people, this is who I am, this is what I do. There's lots of pie out there. This is a long answer, isn't it? Lots of pie out there. There are a lot other opportunities. It's that anxiety we get when we say, if I don't get this one right, then, oh, everything is going to end. It's all going to be wrong. Terrible disaster will follow, right? It's when we go, you know what, this is high stakes, sure, because it's a high ticket item. But if this person, if I am not of service to this person, there is someone else I can be of service to. So stop thinking about it as a sales opportunity and start thinking about it as an opportunity to serve, because Lily, you have gifts that you bring to the table that are unique to you, that only you bring. And so, yeah, there's lots of pie, there's lots of people. And, you know, if we have scarcity mindset and think, boy, if this email doesn't go right, things are going to go terrible for me, you know, that'll give us anxiety and keep us from moving forward. So those are my thoughts right now, just top of mind.
So for me, you can say that the thing that scares me is actually not closing the deal. The thing that scares me is actually because, you know, some people actually want to be paid to speak and others are happy to invest in paying to speak and sponsoring, for example, an event or sponsoring an opportunity for them to speak. I find that some people are actually, especially, let's say, nine-figure millionaires and so on, they get offended sometimes when I say, okay, I have this sponsorship or whatever opportunity. And I find that sometimes because, you know, you meet someone and you don't know them very well and they don't know you very well. Sometimes, yes, you can make a great impression. And sometimes people can see that, for example, I can add a lot of value to their business, introducing them really great clients, even though, let's say, they might not be interested in this sponsorship opportunity. And others, they will get so offended by this suggestion that they might just like not actually decide to continue to see, okay, what we could do together. And that's the thing that scares me. It's not actually not closing the deal. For me, not closing the deal, okay, fine. It's, you know, like you said, it's like millions of people in the world that have wealth. Because I feel like I'm really there to like support, to introduce, to refer great clients, to collaborate. And you can say I'm trying really hard to do it. And that's the thing that actually scares me. Coming back to my next question, what would you say turned you into a resilient leader?
Yeah, good question. Well, I do want to say because I needed this in my own life, right? I'm digging into the research and. The more I get, so first of all, I think we all have a level of endurance and resilience, right? And being an endurance athlete while also being a Fortune 500 executive, you're getting it from both sides and you're learning how to be resilient and how to endure in both of those situations. But when I started on this journey in April I was going through a divorce and lung cancer diagnosis and health scare and all this, I needed endurance in my own life. I needed to figure out how I was going to endure in all of this. So I dug into the research and here's what I found. I found that there are five concepts that create endurance. And because I'm a distance runner, I think of these as like the aid stations along the way. If you go to a mountain trail race, you'll find that people are running on the trail and they get to an aid station. There's like peanut butter sandwiches. There's some, you know, some drinks, some Gatorade, some whatever. And they fuel up and they sit in a chair and they change their shoes. I'm like, oh boy, that's tough. You know, and then they get up and they're going on and they're running 100 miles, 200 miles, et cetera, through the mountains, and these aid stations, they are an oasis in the dark. You know, you want them, you need those aid stations. So I think of these five kind of concepts as aid stations, and I could go through them if you want. But because I'm digging in the peer-reviewed research, and because I have, writing partner and a partner in the business who's got, deep clinical kind of understanding of this stuff, I'm able, from a Fortune 500 executive perspective, to go, all right, what does it mean to how do I stay calm in the middle of a crisis? How do I do that? Or, how do I get my team to be clear on what the purpose and the goals are and all that? How do I go through change personally, and how do I help other people to go through change? How do I make sure that I'm staying connected to other people, and that we're sort of, staying in this, we're in the fight together, right? And then how do I sustain that change over a long period of time? So those are the kinds of, questions that I have as an executive. My writing partner is more like, oh, that's emotional regulation, stress physiology, and that's meaning making and values alignment. And, oh, let me explain how that works to you. And so, between the two of us, we're really homing in on these concepts about what does it take to endure. And because my lens is as a business leader, I own a business today. I was in corporate, settings. And so I was a leader in those organizations, because leadership is my frame and endurance is what I need. And I've got a writing partner who's helping me to really dig into the peer-reviewed research. I'm just learning all this stuff for myself.
Thank you. So let's say someone who gives up easily, how can they become a resilient leader with endurance leadership? What's kind of what's the blueprint for them to become that person? Because I find, for example, let's say I've always considered myself a champion from a really young age, because that was kind of like instilled in my household. My mom used to be an athlete when she was young. And although I've never seen her as an athlete, she was always like running, exercising, this kind of thing. You can say in my entire family, there was this, you can say perfection and excellence was a must. It was like, for example, if I ever got a 9 out of 10, it would be like, I had to explain myself and I had to do extra homework for like 2 hours and so on, but I think other households, where people were brought up in a different way, they don't have this kind of like strong work ethic, and giving up thing is just like a commonplace. Right. So how can someone like that become a resilient leader with endurance leadership?
Yeah, it's a great question, Lily. I think what you're describing is fragility. Right, that we're fragile, that we break easily. And I think that I don't want to be dismissive of this, right? I don't want to go, all you have to do is follow my 5 steps and you'll be okay, right? So I don't want to come off like that. But I want to empathize first, right? So I know what it's like to be crushed. I know what it's like to be under the weight of so many things all at the same time that you just want to go to bed and pull the blanket up over your head. Right. You just, wow. You're going through it and it's hard and you just want to give up. So I think the first step in all that is to sort of regulate yourself. And we have this kind of concept of calm. There in these 5 aid stations that I talk about, there's no hierarchy, but often calm is sort of the entry point to resilience and to endurance. And if I'm out doing a workout, and my coach gave me, I ran the Sydney Marathon, and one of the workouts my coach gave me was to run 10 miles, and in the middle of those 10 miles to run 10 400 meter sprints as hard as I could, or at at least 5K pace or faster. And so I'm on like sprint number 8 in the middle of a 10-mile run, and my face is about to explode and my head is pounding and I just want to stop, right? But as I was on this particular workout, I was on this trail near my house in Mendota. It was near Mendota, Minnesota, and there's this Mendota trail. And I ran into this sort of tunnel of trees. I'm training during the summer, and so there's just this moment where I'm suddenly like, it's the temperature changes a little bit. I'm in a little microclimate, and I'm running, and I'm in the middle of like the eighth sprint out of 10, and I am just dying here. But I notice that there's a little creek that is running beside this part, and I'm now in the shade, and the trees are surrounding me, and the creek is sparkling, and the light is hitting the creek and sending little shots of light up into that sort of tunnel of trees. And I hit this moment where, even though I was exerting myself, even though my body was going, stop it, you know, stop running, this hurts, right? You know, even though I was in that moment, like, I just sort of dropped into myself all of a sudden, and I calmed down for a second, and it really helped me get through that workout. And so, you know, when we can regulate our emotions, when we recognize when we're in a stress reaction, right, that's step number one, is to just calm yourself a little. And, you know, I mean, there are those classical little micro things you can do. You know, there's a concept called breath follows state and state follows breath. And so that sounds kind of woo-woo, right? So, you know, my writing partner is going to say, look, if you have an emotional state, your breathing is going to reflect that. So if you're excited, you're going to be breathing shallowly, and you're going to be... And the other thing happens too, is if we regulate our breath, our emotional state follows, right? So if you calm your breath and you take deep breaths, et cetera, right? So that is a micro move that you can do. But what if I'm a middle manager, right? So maybe I can hold weekly meetings to kind of, instead of putting out fires, we can all get together and we can sort of clarify our focus. And we can go, okay, folks, I know there's a lot going on. Let's just calm for a second. Let's just get present here and let's just focus for a second, right? And that's calming. That's calming the waters a little bit. Or if I'm an executive, I might, you know, one of my favorite phrases that I've been using lately is that chaos is contagious. If the executives in the organization are chaotic, right, and they're just like, and they're all churned up, that is contagious in an organization. But what I'm finding is calm is also contagious. So if I'm an executive in an organization, or I'm a business owner and I have employees that work for me or contractors that work for me, if I find that I am calming myself, if I am practicing composure during volatility, or if I set a tone of calmness during urgency, or there's a crisis situation, I set that tone, that's contagious in an organization. You know, one of the things I liked about Barack Obama, and whether you love him or hate him or whatever, we used to call him No Drama Obama. You know, like, things would be all up in the air and everything, climate change, whatever. And you go, you know, folks, say, listen, you know, he's just all folksy and, you know, sort of calm in the middle of the storm. So as leaders, if we model composure during volatility, if we ourselves are able to calm ourselves and regulate ourselves, then we help others in our organization. If we're middle managers and we're getting our teams together and we're networking with other teams in the organization, we're modeling that kind of composed, let's align on our values, let's stay here, let's stay present, right? And as an individual, if I'm sort of like doing breath work and journaling and other things that help me to calm myself, that's a good start. It's not the entire package, right? It's the first step. So if I'm feeling fragile, if I give up easily, I would say this really also, let me just say this also, there are three things to really look hard at if you are feeling fragile. Eat, sleep, move. Am I eating properly? Am I fueling my body properly? Am I sleeping properly? Am I getting enough deep breaths at night? And then am I moving my body during the day? Do I go for a walk? Do I go for a run? Do I go to yoga? Do I do something that I move my body, right? Eat, sleep, move. Those three things, those are the three key pillars, I think, that endurance is built on.
So. Thank you. How does someone bounce back from failure so they can continue to become a resilient leader?
Yeah. Wow. Boy, you ask the best questions, Lily. No, I think that resilience is a topic in and of itself, right? And part of that is core. Part of that is that calm, right? Part of that is that. And also, I think if I know my why, I can go through any how. So part of bouncing back is knowing where you're bouncing back to. If you have clear vision, if you have clear values, if you have a clear purpose, if I know my why, I can go through any how. And I think that's clearly linked to people who are resilient. They're all often purpose-driven individuals. So,
thank you. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
Sure. If you look at, so my last name has a funny spelling. Most people who spell the name Lloyd, they spell it with two L's. My last name is one L. It's L-O-Y-D. I'm a weirdo like that. So if you go to Tony Lloyd, TonyLoyd.com, you can find out about me. But if you look on social media, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook, I'm around, TonyLoyd.com, and it's TonyLoyd, TonyLoyd.com.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.